This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Economists say the recession of 2008 is officially over, but many people are still out of work. In fact, most of what you read about the recession is that it's not really over for those who have yet to find a new job, but it is over even for those who have lost their jobs. I mean, think about it. Even those who are still working are, in a sense, feeling the effects of the recession, something we haven't heard much about, the effect of recession on people who continue to work. Some of those people took on twice the responsibility for no new pay or perhaps reduced pay. The effect of that kind of pressure has yet to be studied, but experts suspect that we will feel the strain at work and at home for years to come. On today's program, we're going to consider what work is like right now in America and examine the current workplace buzzwords like productivity and efficiency. We're going to start with Kathy Weeks, a professor of women's studies at Duke University, author of the new book, The Problem with Work. Kathy, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
What is the problem with work?
There's a lot of problems with work, but I think I really focus on two. I mean, one is that it monopolizes so much time and energy. I mean, if we include not only the time we work, but the time we spent training for work and preparing for work and searching for work and securing work and then recovering from it, you know, it typically adds up to a huge amount of our life experience, sometimes the best part of our lives, literally. So we're not just expected to work. We're expected to devote a lifetime to work. We're not just expected to work, but become a worker. So the first problem is it dominates so much of life. So much of life is subordinated to work. The second problem, from my perspective, is that work dominates the social and political imagination. So I'm thinking here of all of the social rights and opportunities for participation in the U.S. that are linked to work. You know, it's not just the way that we gain access to income and health care and the rest of it. It's also the way a lot of us develop an identity and gain some kind of, you know, social visibility and status. But even more than that, I think it's the way we really understand our obligations to one another as part of a social and political community. So we're valuable to one another to the extent that we produce, you know, as productive individuals. And I think that really limits our understanding of what a worthy social contribution is to a very narrow conception of wage work, and then makes that a key requirement of citizenship. So the second problem for me is that our ideas about social reciprocity get fixed on and reduced to waged work.
What else is there, though? I mean, we have to be productive. We have to create a society, and part of that has to be generating stuff, and that's what our work does, right?
Yeah, and I think work is necessary, and I think it should be a part of life. What I'm interested in questioning is how much a part of life and how it should be valued. So I think it's important not just to sort of raise questions about the present organization of work, but also, more importantly, about the meaning and value that we associate with work. And this is particularly true in the recession. You know, I mean, there's nothing like being out of work to really highlight how important work is, not only for income, but to gain access to identity and some kind of social status in some ways. You know, I think the recession is showing us that work is not working very well as a way, you know, as a mechanism of economic distribution or social inclusion.
Well, it's a very strange thing. I mean, if you think about an economy that can be in recovery and doing better than it was before the recession and still have 9% of its population unemployed, what does that say about work?
Yeah. Again, I think it's not really working very well. And think also about all of the forms, all the forms of social productivity that aren't covered by the wage system. So this is something that feminists have long recognized when they insisted that unwaged, you know, domestic work, housework, caring for children, caring for the elderly was work, you know, socially necessary labor without which the economy of wage work couldn't function, and yet it isn't rewarded with wages either. So there's all kinds of exclusions within the present wage system.
How much of the way we think about work and the way, as you say, we've attached our identity to it, our sense of social worth, all of those things become bundled in this thing we call our job? How much of that has to do with the way work is structured? I mean, it doesn't have to be this way, right?
No. I think part of it has to do with the hours of work. I mean, just the amount of time that we have to devote to it. But I also think, you know, I think some of it can be attributed also to some of the changes in the economy in some ways. So, you know, I think our ideas, our our attitude about work, you know, our willingness to throw ourselves into work, to, you know, work for long hours, to, you know, invest our personalities in work, is more important to employers in a post-industrial economy than it ever was in an industrial economy. You know, this is in part because part of what employers want are people who will sort of use their attitudes and affects and emotions to, you know, help sell a product in some ways. Right, so employers are really looking for employees with a good attitude about work in order to produce more value. But I think it's also because in many sectors of the service economy, it's much harder to monitor employees, right? So you want employees who are going to monitor themselves, who will be self-disciplined, right? Who have that kind of work ethic so that they can manage themselves. You don't have to manage them in some ways.
Tell us a little bit more. You know, you mentioned the work ethic. This is an idea that sort of creeps into, I mean, we've heard this for a long time. It's a real theory. It's a theory about how work itself became the dominant idea and source of our identity. What impact has that had? And what were we thinking about ourselves before all this? It seems to me that a lot of our work we owned. Right. I mean, you benefited directly from your work. Now, you were part of a social network that also benefited, but that wasn't commodified in nearly as clear a way as it is now. When you actually work for somebody else, you seem to be free. You seem to be able to choose your own job. And that's great freedom. On the other hand, try to get around without a job. So that's the paradox, I suppose, of this freedom in the workplace.
Right. And I also think it's rather ironic that we imagine work, which is usually working under someone else's direction, as, you know, the mechanism for achieving autonomy and freedom. So we don't even sort of recognize the workplace as a site of unfreedom because we associate it so much with that kind of independence. You know, in thinking about the work ethic, I found it's a classic text, but it's wonderful. Max Weber's Protestant Ethic in the Spirit of Capitalism. And I found that really helpful. And he traces it back to certain kinds of Protestant doctrines and then makes the argument that it played a really important role in early capitalist development by encouraging one class of people to work really long and really hard and another class of people to save. But I'm kind of less interested in the empirical argument, you know, whether or not you can trace the original work ethic back to some Protestant arguments, than in the way that Weber does such a good job of sort of making something that's so familiar to us, you know, the psychological and social value of a lifetime of hard work, you know, of making that strange so that we can see it in a new light and ask questions about it. You know, and part of it, he does it by historicizing it. So talking about some of the ideas about work that it supplanted, you know, where work was understood as a part of life, but not the whole of life, where you might have sort of worked in order to live rather than live to work. Right. And then he manages to make our contemporary approach to work, you know, our wholehearted devotion to it seem rather odd so that we can raise questions about it in some ways. So he really, I mean, he gets us to sort of see how odd it is that we are willing, ready and willing to devote so much time to work at the expense of other areas of life and make us sort of recognize in ourselves something like that anxious Protestant with his nose to the grindstone trying to prove his worth to himself and to others. And I think that's a really useful kind of defamiliarization for all of us.
It does that, and it makes us understand there are different attitudes about work and different ways to identify ourselves. But then there are some facts, too, that become pretty interesting in this analysis. I mean, the fact is that once that ethic took hold, we saw for the first time population, instead of rising and falling, rising and falling and rising, about the 16th century or so, population begins to steadily rise and never look back. People are at least living longer, and there are more of them, and there's more choice. Things are coming into the world. I don't have to wear linens and wool anymore. I can, if I get a job and get a little extra money, I can buy calico and chintz and some other lighter fabrics. These are choices. These are things that we consider real developments and improvements in the human condition. And yet we buy into this work ethic that in many ways makes us sick, and a lot of people complain about it, the stress of having to work long hours.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that with all of the achievements of this kind of choice and productivity, we could have in some ways bought more free time with that wealth, you know, reappropriated some of that wealth as time. But we were never given that choice, and it's not a choice that most people have made for a lot of complicated reasons.
What would we do with the time? That's one of the interesting – I mean, you've seen these comparisons all the time, 10 weeks more here in America that we work than the Germans. And certainly back in the feudal period, there were a lot of holidays. People were not working 40-hour weeks.
Right, St. Monday.
They were working hard. Same Monday, right. But suppose we were to go to, say, like a 30-hour work week, which is something that you suggest. What would we do with those 10 hours or 20 for as many of us?
Well, that's part of what interests me about the demand for shorter hours, the 30-hour work week, and other demands too, like the demand for universal basic income, is they really – I mean, certainly they're useful policies that might really – you know, shift some of the ways we relate to work, but I'm more interested in them as kind of provocations. You know, what would you do with that extra time? You know, what would you, you know, if economic necessity was sort of lessened a bit, you know, what would your relationship to work be? You know, if the relationship between work and income was less absolute, what would your relationship to work be? And I think those are really useful questions to ask in some ways. You know, one of the most popular ways that people advocate for shorter working hours, including a 30-hour week, is by saying, well, it'll give more people time for family. And I think that's, you know, a really good argument, and I think that's very important. But, you know, I also think it sort of limits our imagination of it. It doesn't deliver on the promise of that kind of provocation to get us to really think about work differently. You know, then our choices become work or family. You know, I mean, there's this wonderful...
Or bocce ball.
Yes, right, right.
We're going to continue this conversation on the state of things with Duke professor Kathy Weeks. Her new book, The Problem of With Work. Our conversation continues. We're taking your phone calls as well, 877-962-9862. On the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking about working in America. The recession is winding down, but many Americans remain unemployed. For those still on the job, work has increased, but pay hasn't. We're taking a look at what the recession has done to the culture of work in America. Kathy Weeks is in the studio today. She's a professor of women's studies at Duke and the author of the book, The Problem with Work. Joining me now is Martha Crowley, a professor of sociology at North Carolina State University, and Alan Lind is with us. He's James Vincent Professor of Leadership at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. And Clara Jeffrey is co-editor of Mother Jones Magazine, also co-author of a recent cover story called The Speed Up. I want to welcome all of you to the show. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're taking your calls as well, 877-962-9862, SOTWUNC.org. Tell us about work, the recession, how we think about it, how you view it, how you like it. Let's start with that term speed up, Clara. What does it mean? Where did it come from?
Well, Webster's defines it as an employer's demand for accelerated output without increased pay. Basically, fewer employees do more work, and I think that that's really the dirty secret of the jobless recovery, is that it accelerated a trend of the last 30 years, which is basically offloading work, often of fired employees, onto the remaining workforce. So everybody essentially works harder, you know, 1.5 jobs for the same rate of pay or even less pay than they were making before.
And Martha, now we don't call it a speed up anymore. It's called productivity. That sounds pretty good. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's much more acceptable from the corporate point of view to call it productivity rather than the speed up. The classic worker take on it was the speed up, and as the article points out, they used to refer specifically to the speed up. It's been repackaged in a way that I think sort of taps into what Kathy is talking about. About our ideas about work that have been sold to us in this corporate economy.
I mean, it is interesting, Clara, that people don't talk about it, that the term itself, we understand why businesses and economists want to use the term productivity, but why workers don't, or why somehow there hasn't been a single voice that recognizes this isn't helping me.
Well, I think two factors. One is very simple. It's the declining clout and membership of unions, which sort of both provided a wage floor and also representation not only for their workforce but more broadly. And the second is, I think that people, especially in the recession, were sold that this is what companies have to do to make it through. And that's all well and good, except that corporate profits are back up 22% over the point they were before the recession. In European countries, the workforce has been hired back, and Asian countries, the workforce has been hired back, but we still have this incredibly low dip in our employment. And basically, that's because corporations have figured out that they can shove the work onto the remaining workforce. And I think people don't see beyond their own place of employment or maybe their own industry, kind of are able to look up and see that this is happening across industries and across the entire economy.
Is that it, Alan Lind? Why is it that workers seem to accept this? I mean, and if you take a look, and perhaps not everybody who has a job realizes, but the top 1% of wage earners has gotten something like a 240% increase since 1979 compared to maybe a 79% increase in their wages. It's a huge differential. So all this productivity doesn't go to the people working the hardest. Why do we accept it?
I think one of the answers is during the recession, there was always the threat that you too could lose your job, that there were people waiting out there to take your place. I think that mentality remains a bit. We still have this high unemployment rate. There's still the perception you're lucky to have a job, so you better just suck it up and do what you need to do to accomplish what you're asked to do. The other thing I think that's going on, Frank, is that we know that we have the capacity to expand our work. We know that we have the capacity to do more. We don't, and those who employ us don't tend to think of the cost associated with that. So we don't think if I work harder today and tomorrow and for the next week and the next month, there begin to become psychological costs associated with it. I get stressed out. I get fatigued. The idea that employers have discovered that they can ask us to do this and we'll do it, you know, it invites them to keep asking us to do more. And I think they, too, don't look at the downside costs, the risks that are associated with this additional effort.
And I think people have really hit their limit. I mean, we interviewed people in all different walks of life, from people stocking in warehouses to air traffic controllers and surgeons, and their exhaustion, they've completely hit the capacity of what they can do, and I think that will have an impact on the productivity rate of what employers can see, but it also has a really profound impact on people's lives, their family lives, their personal relationship, and their health.
Oh, I quite agree. I think we're going to see and are seeing an increase in stress-related psychological reactions. So we see more irritability. We see more use of drugs or alcohol. We see more sort of dysfunctional behaviors that people do as they try to deal with stress. From the employer's perspective, I think we see more errors. We see more conflict in the workplace, all related to this, but we're not making the connection yet, I don't think.
But it's a robust system in terms of its ability. The system seems to be able to adapt, Martha, and this gets to some of your research. There was a time when, back in the old factory days when manufacturing was king and line production was the way things went, clearly that was very productive, very mechanistic, break each job into its component parts. That had its limits, but the system, the workplace, adapted to that. We're seeing more flexibility now.
Yes, and we're not actually oftentimes even in academia making the link to the original changes that were behind the speed up in manual production. But if you go back and you read the guiding principles of scientific management that were put in place where work was divided and then speeded up, you'll actually see a lot of what's coming into play today, but it's being labeled flexibility. Really, there's a huge emphasis on getting the right people on the bus. And business writers, there's a writer named Jim Collins, he wrote a book called Good to Great on what did corporations do in the 1990s. And this is before the recession began, by the way. And he talks about, the ones that did it best, that had the biggest increases in stock prices, focused on getting the right people on the bus, and as importantly, or maybe even more importantly in his mind, getting the wrong people off. And it's very much related to what you see today, a withdrawal of commitment to employees. And we saw it in manual production in the 1980s with layoffs and outsourcing and capital flight overseas. We're seeing it now in white-collar work and specifically in the professional environment where there's a lot of focus on being the right person. And again, Kathy kind of spoke to this issue. Being the hard worker, putting a smiling face on it, being more than happy to give it all for the corporation. And it's very much related to what the pioneers of scientific management talked about, but it was imperfectly applied in the 20th century. We see it perfectly applied now.
It is interesting. And one of those pioneers was a man named Frederick Taylor, who was considered the father of scientific management around the turn of the 20th century. This is a quote. It's in your report. And he's talking about a machine company and how things improved radically using his methods. That 35 girls were able to do the work which formerly required about 120 is due not only to the improvement in the work of each girl owing to better methods, but to weeding out of the lazy and unpromising candidates and the substitution of more ambitious individuals. It's written about 1903.
Exactly. And there are a couple of things going on there. One is getting rid of people. And then what happens after that is the message that it sends to the people left behind. What will happen to you if you don't perform? And you can see that in his work. You can see that today. People are very, very fearful. And it's not incidental to what's happening. It's actually cultivated by employers. In fact, some will talk explicitly about fear being one of their greatest tools in controlling workers and getting the most out of them. And it's an important component of the stress that people feel, the strife that they feel in their relationships at work and at home, the resentment that they feel toward management, and ultimately the withdrawal of commitment to the firms. That we might not see it now while people are afraid of losing their jobs and they don't have a lot of options. But once things open up a little bit, I think we're going to see not only the effects of the long-term stress that people are experiencing, but also the effects of people's own withdrawal of commitment to their employers. They're holding their employers at arm's length. Richard Sennett has called it an armor of detachment. It's a way to self-protect against the indignity of what employers are doing to employees.
Well, before we get to the effects of that, the short and long-term effects, Kathy Weeks, I want to talk about some of the ways that this fear can be reinforced. Part of that is once you create a system of wage labor and you break up the social networks that it replaced, it becomes very hard for you to go anywhere else. So when the employer says, either explicitly or not, you're lucky to have a job, you believe that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why Marx called it a system of forced labor. You aren't really, you know, marched off to work at the point of a gun, but you don't really have other options. So it's forced in that sense in some ways.
What do we do, though, Ellen, in terms of the long-term effects of this stuff? We talked about this armor of distance that we're putting between. What's the impact on the workplace? But long-term, what does it mean for any kind of social networks and social order?
I think it takes some real effort to overcome it. I think we need to be mindful. I think we need to say, is this person getting used up? Does this person need to be recreated somehow? Do they need to be replenished? And what I see in really intelligent modern management is people begin to look at that, but that's far from the norm. I think there are folks out there who say, okay, this is the workday and that's the end of it. And if we need more capacity, we bring in more people. Your battery's used up and we're going to let you recharge a little bit. But that's far from the norm, I think.
Clara, in putting together your article, what's your sense of the impact of this on the workplace itself?
Well, I mean, like I mentioned, we interviewed people, and you can read those as told to at motherjones.com, as well as a lot of charts and graphs to sort of show you how bad it is out there. But people are really at their breaking point. And in some cases, this doesn't just endanger them. It endangers the rest of us. I mean, we interviewed an air traffic controller who, talks about having no brakes, no backup. You know, he's trying to put 10 planes through one little hole in the sky, and he phases out because he hasn't gotten enough sleep. And, you know, the answer to this when air traffic controllers were found to be falling asleep on the job was that our transportation secretary, Ray LaHood, said they're not going to be able to nap on the job. Well, speaking for myself, I would prefer that they be given structured naps on the job if that's what it takes to keep all of us safe. So I think that there are impacts that we feel personally and that we will start to see societally. I think beyond just the sort of how can we reform our own individual workplaces, there are broader political decisions that need to be really taken into consideration.
Such as?
Well, I mean, essentially, you know, we've been handing more and more political power over to corporations, and we just had an opportunity where, you know, Wall Street pretty much almost completely destroyed the global economy, and we completely failed in our attempts to regulate them. And there have just been a series of Supreme Court decisions in the last few weeks that have further weakened any kind of check on corporate power. And I think citizens need to put pressure on their lawmakers to establish a better balance.
We have come to believe, though, that these corporations are our lifeblood. I mean, if you're worried about the corporation going under and that's why you're going to work 70 hours for no more pay, it suggests that you won't live without this corporation. We've sort of internalized that message, haven't we, Alan?
I think so. I think that we have become so self-motivated about work that it's not someone else driving us necessarily. I have a student who's a critical care pediatric physician, and his answer to work-life balance is, I can't have work-life balance. I'm a physician. It becomes part of who we are. I'm a hard worker, and I'm proud of it. And it's not someone pushing me. It's me pushing me.
Well, and Martha, there's a quote in your report, a private contractor who says, quote, I want to make sure that when they're laying off contractors, I'm the last one on the list. So I do a lot of things like come on board for the first 2 weeks, maybe work 70 hours a week, bill them for 40. And I had been there a week when I noticed that there were six in the morning until six at night. So I'm going to do this. I know the profit's going to go to the company. I've given up 30 hours of pay here in order to keep this job. And you saw, I mean, this is not just one example, pretty typical of what you found?
Extremely typical of what we found, not only here, also in the UK. It's received a lot of attention there, overwork, underemployment, and fear and unhappiness, stress, withdrawal of commitment. It's pervasive.
I want to go to the phones now. Greg is on the line from Durham. Hello, Greg.
Good afternoon. One of the problems I see is we as adults have been educated by the modern media to believe this way. When you start looking at commercials, you're taught that you need to have a bigger and better house and car, and you need this fancy material goods, instead of being taught that you need to take some time and enjoy a simple vacation. Our idea of vacation is getting on a jet and flying to Europe. And so part of the problem is we are taught to believe we have to live this type of lifestyle to have a full and complete lifestyle.
As an expression of our freedom, thank you, Greg, that we are free to choose the color of the car and the size of the house and the place we go on our vacation for 10 days and then get back to work.
Well, and isn't it interesting that, you know, throughout the past decade, as salaries stagnated and workloads grew, Wall Street handed us a credit bubble that allowed us to drown our sorrows in, you know, granite countertops and mega mansions and, you know, pick your opiate,
right.
Basically.
Well, and interestingly enough, that credit bubble grew when wages were pretty much flattened out in the 1980s when unions went the way of the dodo.
Exactly.
So without organized labor, you don't have wages. Without wages, oh, nobody's buying our stuff. How do we do? Oh, I know, credit cards. And so no coincidence there. But the structure never changes. How would that work? I mean, do we... Let me ask you, Kathy Weeks, what happens? People were at one point, at least in the 20th century, organized about their work. We thought about work in a way that made people get together and form unions. It doesn't seem to be that way anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's a complicated story about the decimation of unions, but also about the kind of individuation of work. You know, I mean, there's so many different kinds of schedules and relationships to work that people have. You don't, the model of the mass factory where everyone goes in together and has a similar kind of experience and can talk to one another is no longer, you know, the economic model. I think it makes it very hard to organize in relationship to work, given that economy. That's why I think in some ways it's better to sort of not organize on the basis of any particular industry, but in terms of, you know, national policies about wages and hours and at that level.
It is interesting that we associate part of that identity that we get from work is our sense of freedom, our individual will is expressed through this job and the things it'll buy us, Alan.
It is indeed. I think we do internalize it. I think we do internalize it quite young. I understand the Weberian argument about it coming from Protestant tradition, but I have to say there's a scale of the Protestant ethic that had its highest ratings in a Japanese community in California. So it's worldwide now. I think it's catching on worldwide, and that contagion drives us all the harder because now we're not only in competition with that 9% of Americans who don't have jobs, but how many Indians or Chinese or name your culture. We want to excel. We want to be special. And the easiest way to do that for some of us is to excel at our work. And that can mean extra hours.
On the State of Things today, we're talking about working through the recession. Kathy Weeks is here. Alan Lynn from Duke University. Martha Crowley from NC State. Clara Jeffrey from Mother Jones Magazine. Our conversation continues. We're taking your phone calls as well. 877-962-9862. Stay with us on the State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour about working in America. Even though the recession is technically over, many Americans remain unemployed. And what has work been like for those left behind? What about the folks who don't have work and maybe a long time before they find a job? Our guest, Kathy Weeks, Duke professor, author of The Problem with Work. Alan Lind is a professor at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke. Martha Crowley is a professor of sociology at NC State. Clara Jeffrey, co-editor of Mother Jones Magazine. Taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Kathy Weeks, part of it, you know, we go back and forth over this question of the speed up, which is me working more for not much more money, and productivity, which is the company making a whole lot more money. And it does seem to me that the way we measure economic success in this country is part of the problem. And part of that issue is the way we value domestic work, all of the infrastructure, the social infrastructure that makes the other economy possible.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, this whole project of trying to, you know, think about what counts as work and think about how we value it, I think it's really important to contemporary feminist politics of work, which is really centered around, first, the struggle to get women equal access to wage work. So I think of this as more work for women. You know, and then second, the much more difficult and less successful project of trying to gain, you know, recognition and social support and men's equal, you know, responsibility for unwaged domestic work, which I think of as better work for women. And those are both really important projects. The danger with both of them is that they end up sort of reinforcing the overvaluation of work, whether it be waged work or unwaged domestic work. I mean, in some ways, it's still work in some ways. You know, there's still in both of those discourses a tendency to elevate work over other kinds of experiences. So the problem that I'm really struggling with is how to gain recognition for unwaged domestic caring labor as work, as, again, socially necessary labor that requires, for example, I think, more time off waged work to accomplish, but not to overvalue it as such, you know, not further the moralization and sanctification because it's work. And I think that's a very difficult thing to do.
So it's a question of metrics. It's what we measure. And of course, we have metrics for things that we value, and we don't have metrics for these other things, which suggests that we don't give them the same value, unless there's something called work, as you
right.
suggest.
Exactly. Or we can try to put a metric on it. We can try to monetize it. So a man will say, oh, I'm contributing to my children. I'm saving money for their college, you know, instead of I'm investing my time with them. There's some interesting statistics, which I don't have on the top of my head, but around the issue of paternity leave, where when paternity leave is made available, and this is a problem sometimes for maternity leave, the problem is with getting highly motivated people to take it. So there's a tendency to say, oh, I don't want to be off work for
right.
that long. Even though it makes sense.
Yeah, Martha.
That goes back to the fear issue then again. There are quite a few people who've studied this in sociology, and they interview people about why they're not taking advantage of these family leave policies, and they talk about how there are long-term career implications for taking advantage of them, for men and for women. And when you don't take them, it then sets a standard of not taking them, and then the people who might be inclined to take them are even less inclined to take them, because they don't want to be gauged against that. There's a constant fear of being labeled the non-producer, the person who's not happy, the person who wants a way out, the person who might actually need sleep or need family time. And it's so interesting that we look at sleep and family time as antithetical to what we label as work, and specifically to wage work when they're necessary. Family time reproduces the next generation of workers for capital. Sleep regenerates each worker to go back out the next day and produce.
You do end up in that same with that same problem, though, even with the example that you used. So I can come up with the research that shows if you give people more time with their family and a little more time to sleep, they'll be, oops, better workers, and they'll produce more for your company. And we get back, so we never really changed the paradigm. I just throw that out there. Clara, I don't know if you have anything to say about that, but it is interesting that the only way we can think about changing the paradigm is to bringing it back to money, how much money this new progressive policy is going to make for your publicly traded company.
Well, I mean, another way to change the paradigm is to pass some basic laws. I mean, the U.S. is one of only six countries in the world that doesn't mandate some amount of paid maternity leave. We're one of only nine countries in the world that doesn't mandate some amount of paid annual leave. And we're one of only 16 countries in the world that doesn't mandate some amount of weekly time off. And I think this is where we see, without some sort of worker organization, whether it's in traditional unions as we've known them or something yet to come, that fighting for just sort of basic, you know, rights of the workers benefits everybody, whether or not they are in those unions themselves. And you know, it's just sort of appalling when we're, you know, there with Papua New Guinea and Swaziland is one of the few countries in the world that doesn't have paid maternity leave. It's not an option for most families in the country to only get by on one income now. We've completely transformed the workplace and home life as a result. And so, you know, simple arithmetic reveals that if women are doing wage work, the housework that they used to do has to be done by somebody.
877-962-9862 is the number to call. Paul is on the line from Duncan. Hello, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hey, I had a couple of comments. One thing with regard to the unions, they were been demonized since the 80s, and there's real no balance of power. You know, big companies like IBM used to treat their employees like gold when there was unions around. Now that they've fallen away, the rights of workers are just getting trampled on, and wages are falling accordingly. And, you know, over the last 4 years, people may be working, but many of them took 18-20% cuts in pay. And when they were laid off, are making 30-40% less than they were before. So when we talk about the recession being over, I don't think it's true. And, you know, down here in North Carolina, employment's still about 10%. Yeah. People 10 years ago were making more than minimum wage. Now they're making minimum wage. So I just think there's just no balance of power. And I think big corporations and the government basically put the unions out of business. And they're not without their own blame. But I'd like to hear your comments on that.
All right. Thanks for the call, Paul. 877-962-9862. So workers perhaps organizing, thinking about who's making this money, who's getting the extra productivity is one thing. But we had a call earlier, too, that suggested that consumerism, that the way we buy has a lot to do with it. So not only withholding your work might change things, but withholding our spending. You know, the idea of a boycott, of not actually buying this stuff. You know, you get growth under 3% a year, and that system starts to look mighty anemic.
I think that's true, although I would remind everyone that, you know, 1 year's earnings at the minimum wage is about $15,000, and the income required for a single worker with no kids, no family, to have real economic security is double that. So, for a vast majority of people, it's not that they're living beyond their means. It's that they can't keep up.
877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join our program. Tom is on the line from Durham. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Yep. You have a question for us or an observation?
Yeah, sure do. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of the the lore that we're handed down is that labor compensation is set by the market. And then I'm thinking of another piece of lore, which is that Henry Ford decided to pay his workers a wage that would enable them to buy the product. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that kind of solution is possible today, where employers would decide to pay workers what it takes to get along in the modern economy.
Thanks for the call, Tom.
It seems to me that employers do, when they're hiring, look at the market, but they probably also realize a point that we've talked about before, which is once I'm employed, there's some costs associated to me, certainly to them as well, but to me in leaving and going to another job. So they don't necessarily advance wages to keep track with the labor market if they have people who are in positions. I don't know of many people who are pricing their workers to be able to afford their product.
Yeah, it seems to me they don't have to.
Well, on the contrary, I mean, I think it's about 1 in 100 American workers works for Walmart, and those low prices, it's sort of the inverse of Henry Ford's philosophy. If we pay our workers so little, they'll shop at our superstore because the prices are lower.
Mm.
So it's, it can be reinforced on a downward trend as well.
877-962-9862 is the number to call. Martha?
Well, one thing that doesn't get a lot of attention when we talk about Henry Ford and his $5 day is that if you go back and look at the origins of that, a big part of it was a response to resistance and turnover among workers. Talking about allowing them to afford the product was a nice face on it, really, but there was a lot of worker discontent. It was a good way to deal with it, and we see the same thing today. Professionals are pushed to the brink. White-collar workers are pushed to the brink. Some manual workers are pushed to the brink, either in terms of hours and pressure or also just, especially among manual workers, mind-numbing, terrible conditions. And to the degree that they've been able to secure higher payment for those, it actually puts them in a greater bind because they then become sort of addicted to making that money. It becomes their standard, and we don't know necessarily how to cut back, and that happens in professional work and in manual work. And there's also bifurcation. So some people are pressed more and paid more, and other people are not able to get enough hours or enough pay. So we're sort of talking about two different phenomena.
Well, the other issue, too, I mean, another way to look at what Henry Ford did, not only the $5 day, the other thing he wanted to do was keep the cost of his cars low. And one year decided to withhold the dividend, was taken to court by two of his more notable shareholders, who later went on to form the Dodge Corporation, and lost, even though he was the majority share owner of his own company. Share value trumped whatever the company wanted to do, even if it had some kind of and it wasn't even a social good. He wanted to keep the price low so more people could have as a marketing technique. If more people see these cars, more people want these cars. But the idea that the value of the share is going to be trumped, that nothing is more important to that than that, has become kind of the dominant force that structures our workplace. Wouldn't you say, Kathy Weeks? I mean, that's why we have jobs the way we are. We walk into them. We don't really have much negotiating. You don't walk into a job. There's a job description. You answer it. You don't walk in and say, here's what I can do.
Right. And it makes me, going back to this question about, do we work in order to get consumption goods? I mean, I think that's definitely true. That's one way to explain why we're so willing to work long and hard, is so we can get more stuff. But I'm thinking about all the people, too, who maybe find consolation in consumption goods because they have to work so long and hard in some ways. And there the fault is really with these long hours rather than people's excessive consumer desires. And I think that's another way to look at it.
Well, it gets to this question, too, when people ask, what are we going to do with that other 10 hours? And the idea is that we're going to go do something crazy,
right.
The eagle flies on Friday. Well, that's because the week was so miserable that we went crazy on the weekend. Perhaps if you had a better balanced life, that's not what you would do with your Friday night.
Right. I mean, I think that's what's also very interesting is that this kind of fear of free time, you know, where we imagine it'll end up in shopping or criminality somehow. Like those are the two choices, where I really think that most people find other ways to sort of be creative and even productive in some ways if you open up that notion of what counts as a productive activity.
Yeah, but one of those activities might be thinking up new ways to do work. And at least 1% of the population doesn't want to hear that. Clara, what about movement to make some of the changes? You talked about it at the legislative level. Do you see any movement to sort of people recognizing what's going on and doing something about it?
Well, that was the sort of, you know, cry from the heart that this article was trying to get to, is basically allowing people to look up past their own personal problems and see that this is a much larger issue. And I have to say, I mean, this is, you know, just in the last few weeks since this has been out, we've heard from a phenomenal number of people, including people who are executives at Fortune 500 companies who've told us, you know, that their profits are booming, and yet they are again being told to lay people off and to sort of push the work off on the remaining workforce because you know, their bosses see that they can continue to get away with this. So I do think part of it, I mean, this is, you know, sort of touchy-feely, but it's just looking up, seeing that this is happening to you and to your friends and neighbors and talking about it, because that's where political action comes from, ultimately.
If you have the time to sit around and talk.
Well, yes, exactly.
Alan, do you think, I mean, does it come to the point where the fear is so profound and the system is so sort of airtight that really no amount of talking or thinking about it is going to create change in the human mind that will actually say, enough is enough, I'm going to change this?
I think that will happen eventually. As a psychologist, I understand we often don't see reality very clearly, but I think we often do see reality ultimately. And it seems to me that on both a personal level and organizational level, the problems associated with this will continue to mount to the point where people need to do things. I know of consultants who are now saying to small business owners, you need to cut back your work week because you're suffering errors, you're exposing yourself to litigation. There are a variety of bad things that are happening because your people are overworked and they're just overstressed. I think I'm not a political scientist, so I don't know the prospects for political change, but I do see some prospects for organizational change down the road.
Martha, I've only got about 30 seconds left. Any ideas?
Well, I think that what we're doing now is among the most important things that we can do is talk to people and help them understand what's going on. And I think that it has implications for political change and demands that we make on our employers and our government, because if we stop internalizing stress, keeping it to ourselves, seeing what's actually going on, supporting each other, and stop pointing the finger in the wrong direction. Unemployed people stop pointing the finger at people who have jobs. People who have jobs stop pointing the finger at their coworkers, or even at their managers who are also under stress themselves, as you said, and realize what's happening and director action in the right place.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Martha Crawley, Professor of Sociology at North Carolina State, Alan Lynn, James Vincent, Professor of Leadership at the Fuqua School at Duke, Clara Jeffrey, co-editor of the Mother Jones magazine piece called The Speed Up, and Kathy Weeks, Professor of Women's Studies at Duke and the author of the book The Problem with Work. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.